Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
What gives these people the right to think like this? Someone else is making money. Oh, we better put a stop to that. It's just disgusting business behaviour for one thing.
More on that later as we talk about how European mobile networks may be changing your web experience. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson. We start with this week's picks from the UK tech news. Joining me is one Mr. Ian Morris.
Hello.
Hello indeed. Now, in the previous version of that hello, in a dry run recording, Ian said, good afternoon or good morning.
And then realised I didn't know where I was or what I was doing or what I was saying or what even indeed my name was.
Yes, working under the kimono of jet lag. Today is Mr. Morris. Never mind, let's start by talking about Uber. Apparently, London's famous black cabs are in danger of being run out of town by Uber. Now, this is according to Bloomberg, which, obviously, full disclosure, I work for, but I didn't want to ignore this story just because I work for Bloomberg. And the report says that TfL, the transit authority here in London, has shown that black taxi license applications are down 20% so far this year, and Uber is getting the blame. Not only that, but people looking to take the knowledge, which is the sort of Uber exam, that was a very terrible Freudian slip, the sort of epic exam that black taxi drivers have to pass in order to get their license, where they have to memorize about 25,000 streets and 20,000 landmarks in London. Applications to take that test have fallen by more than two-thirds at one of the examination centers, and that's largely because people driving Uber do not need to take the knowledge because they have GPS in all of their cars. So why is this particularly bad? Well, at the moment, there are about 15,000 Uber drivers working in London. There are about 25,000 black cabs. So there are still fewer Ubers than black cabs. But in New York, there are already now more Ubers than licensed taxis in that city. So we are sort of seeing a trend that has happened in New York of Uber basically stamping in the way of the local taxis. We've seen that happen over there, and we're seeing the same trends happening over here. Now, Ian, before we go into talking about, well, my view, what is your view on this?
My view is that I don't care even vaguely about black cabs, and I think they've had their day. The problem for me is that they're just so expensive. I've got this anecdote that I roll out every now and then. I once got a taxi from an awards ceremony in central London out to Waterloo, and it cost me £12. And I realised when I got there that Waterloo wasn't decided not to run any trains, as Southwest sometimes do. And then so I went back to the awards ceremony, and that whole journey cost me £25. Near enough, and then the journey home in the Uber later cost me £25 to go, you know, what, 25 miles.
I think you've got a point on the price. I mean, for me, it's not. I mean, the price can be offset with the fact that there are loads of them all over the place, and you can just put your hand out and jump into one. You know, you're paying there for convenience.
You,
and
like me, I'm sure, must have stood around waiting for a black cab to turn up and feeling more and more frustrated by it, and then feeling like you're being overcharged, you know, not overcharged, but because the rate is set by someone else. But you know, it is a very expensive service.
It is, but I have to jump in because there is another aspect to this. So it's not really the price that concerns me here. I think it is, on the one hand, there is the incredible convenience that is Uber, because it's not just about the cost there. It's about the fact that you can see when one is coming. You can see where they are. You can, you know, you don't have to wait around outdoors in the rain, for example, if you're waiting for an Uber, because you can literally see it on the map of your screen. When it's coming up to you, you can call them ahead of time if needs be, or they can call you more to the point when they're lost and can't find you. That is very convenient. But the other problem that I have more frequently with cars, and I was having this with a conversation in an Uber with a friend the other day, which is that, you know, a lot of cabbies, you know, they're not going to take cards, and they're not going to take cards happily because they'd much rather have the cash for reasons I won't go into now. But there is a reason that a lot of them do prefer cash. And you can sometimes have a bit of an awkward conversation with them over that. You know, they just want cash and no cards, and, you know.
And they won't go south of the river.
Exactly. It's a challenge. And whereas with Uber, you don't necessarily have that same problem. And in my experience, that's great. When you combine it with the cost, that's fine. The problem here is, I think, is the risk to the status quo, if you like. And I think that that's more of a problem for the industries internally than it is for passengers. At the end of the day, we just want to get from one place to another. And if the black cabs had innovated in the same way that Uber had, then we wouldn't be in this problem. The question is, have they had the technology as a kind of distributed network? You know, they are centrally managed, but they're not centrally managed in that there's like a switchboard. You just jump in a black cab. They've not innovated quickly enough, and Uber is, and it's part of the problem that Uber is just a better experience, therefore people are using it, therefore the people who didn't take cards and didn't have apps and didn't innovate are getting pissed off that they're losing their business. And I think, well, that is a problem, yes, but I can't blame it. I mean, which would you rather do? And you know, faffing around with cash on drunk nights, you know you're going to get paid anyway.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, there's also options for them if you mess up their cab and things like that. I don't know. I just can't understand how black cabs have survived this long, really.
Well, let's keep our eye on this. Let us know what you think. podcast@natelangson.com. Particularly interested, of course, if you've had a bad experience with Uber and a better experience in a black cab. Why do you think that is? Are you a driver? Do you know one? Maybe you'd like to take one and interview the driver about why they don't drive black cabs anymore. Let's move on to the next topic. This is another app-based London-centric story. An app that promises users a video doctor consultation within an hour and medication delivery to London addresses within 4 hours is due to launch in the next month. This is an app written about on wired.co.uk called Doctor Now, and has been created by doctors to plug the gap in care not left by traditional GPs necessarily, but it's launched to try and relieve some of the strain on A&E, which is a real problem at the moment. About 30% of A&E cases, it's estimated at least, could actually be classified as GP cases, which means someone's going in for something not necessarily that urgent and is stopping someone going in and having a spike removed from their kidney.
Yes.
And this launch follows a launch of an app that came out last year that I remember talking about quite a lot back then on Wired's podcast called Babylon, which was a remote consultation service set up by a former Goldman Sachs banker called Ali Parser, who very interesting bloke. Now, this is an interesting app because you can pay $4.99 per month for unlimited appointments. They've got about 250 doctors. They're all licensed doctors. You're not just getting people who say, I can identify a lung. I can tell you that smoking's bad for you. I'll tell people that for £5. It's all licensed medical professionals. But you can also, and this is the interesting one, you can also pay just £29 for a one-off appointment. Now, I think this is really weird because $4.99 a month gets you unlimited appointments. Let's say £5 a month for unlimited or £30 for a one-off appointment. I feel this actually appeals to hypochondriacs because if you're the kind of person who regularly needs to ask doctors questions, the value proposition here of paying just a £5 a month for as many as you want is so, so much more compelling than £30 to just do it once. Well, I really, really believe that this is going to be the hypochondriac's absolute dream.
But you've just identified two different people, haven't you, really? So there will be the hypochondriacs, and they will subscribe. And there will be the people who just have a one-off problem who won't subscribe. Like, I would probably... I mean, I don't know why I would, because my doctor's quite good, and I can get an appointment the same day, any day, and they're open 365 days a year. So I would probably not use this service.
Where do you live at the moment, Ian?
I live in Surrey.
Roughly.
You know,
Surrey, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not central London.
No.
Because I've had to wait sometimes a week for a GP appointment down here, you know, and it might not be something particularly serious, you know, I don't know, a stomach problem that seems to be going on for a little bit longer than normal, something like that, where it can go completely in the space it takes to get a doctor's appointment.
Yeah.
And all right, that's fine, that's good, maybe that cancels the need for the appointment. But what actually if that was something more serious? I've been fortunate that it never has been, but it really could be. And waiting a bloody week for a doctor's appointment is just ridiculous.
But you would be able to get an emergency appointment, right?
You can, but then you run the risk of not having an emergency appointment because everyone thinks that any pain they've got is an emergency.
Yeah, I mean...
Fortunately, smart people don't... You know, they appreciate that what is probably just a pain or a muscle spasm or IBS or whatever, they are smart enough not to say, yeah, it's an emergency.
Yeah.
And if it really is an emergency, then maybe do go to A&E.
Minor injuries are very good.
Going back to the app, one of the things that I think is really interesting about this as a proposition is that technically speaking, you could use this anywhere you are. So even if you could get an appointment with a GP, but let's say you travel a lot, and if you have a problem maybe caused by a flight, I don't know, I'm trying to think of ailments I've had where I've thought I could use this. I remember once what was basically probably eating some bad food on a flight in New York, not wanting to try and figure out how to see a doctor in New York. I would have loved the opportunity to dial up this app as part of my subscription and do that from my hotel room and get, you know, impartial, medically certified advice within an hour.
Yeah.
I think that's a compelling thing to do. Or if you live a long way away. I mean, again, we talk about this in London, but I mean, if you are somewhere out in the sticks, then it might actually take you, you might be able to get an appointment with, you know, that day, but it might take you 4 hours to get there because you live in a, you know, in a hut in the middle of some moors.
I do get what you're saying, but the NHS does provide, I mean, you can call your doctor, for example. So you could just, you know, call reception and go, hey, listen, I'm in New York. I think I've had something dodgy. Could I just talk to a doctor and get a phone appointment? And they probably like that because it will take a lot less time than a regular appointment. And they'll just go, yeah, it's fine. Or, oh, well, if it's gone on this long, then perhaps you should go and see someone locally or something.
You're right. The other side of this, though, is that this is a video doctor consultation. So
right.
The doctor can see you. So if you had something horrific.
I do not know how that would help. Seriously, what sort of conditions can you, diagnose over FaceTime?
Loads, mate.
Really?
Absolutely. Without question. Absolutely.
I don't.
Think about, you know, a skin ailment, somebody worrying, oh, is this...
I've got to say now, I just don't think, I don't think a doctor would do it that way. Because you need to see it. Every time I've had a skin condition, say, and I've been to a doctor, or my daughter has, you know, they need to touch it to really understand what they're dealing with. That's the training. It's part of being thorough. I mean, I do get what you're saying. I don't think it's a bad idea. I'm happy with it. I just don't think it's going to be the be all and end all or the solution to the problems of everyone and the problems that we have with everyone needing doctors all the time. There are too many of us. That's the problem.
The other side of this is that they are setting up NHS-approved pharmacies in... there's one outside of London and one inside. And these are, according to the Wired article, acting as warehouses for medical deliveries, which means that if a doctor on this app needs to prescribe something, and I do believe that this couldn't be used for... what's the word? Kind of like ongoing medication, but for things like... one-off medication,
right.
Like if I don't know, you need some sleeping tablets for something, or you've got an allergy. I don't believe they're going to be able to use this for things like I don't know, the kind of thing where you get things on repeat prescription. Basically, I think this is going to be more for I've got a pain, or I feel sick, or
I've got a leg off.
Yeah, one of my legs has fallen off, or my blood's turned green, and I've got a second head. I think that's going to be what it is. But anyway, we could go down this little rabbit hole of hypochondria-related discussions for a while, but we shan't. Safe to say that there's a write-up on Wired, Wired.co.uk, if you want to have a look at that.
I mean, we can't be very far away, can we, from, you know, Apple having, like, say, like HealthKit, having something where you can send a blood sample over the internet. Like, we can't be far away from that, can we?
That's true. No, I think that's probably quite close.
This would come to the point where these services would be even more useful. You know, you take a blood thing and send it off, and then the doctor can see that, and you don't need to go in. It'd be brilliant.
Well, I'm sure that's happening, being developed now. I think the other thing is there's going to be adapters for blood tests that you can plug into the bottom of your iPhone. Mm. Like, there already are Bluetooth things, I think, for diabetics. So
there are indeed, yeah.
And it's going to be not too long. But I do also slightly worry that it gives people the opportunity to think they're ill a lot more than they actually are.
I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with that. Like, sometimes I think that, you know, having access to information can help reduce the hypochondria. I found that I was a lot less worried about my health when I just went to the doctor a bit. You know, like, because everyone goes through phases in their life where they're just constantly at the doctor, don't they? Like, you know, you just have a run of bad luck or something. And when you do that, you kind of, I don't know, it settles you a bit somehow. I mean, maybe that's just me, but yeah. You know, and I was a pretty bad hypochondriac. Now I don't worry. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I've been prone to that in the past, but generally speaking, my advice is just
go.
Don't think about it. Yeah. Or just go to the doctor because they generally tell you it's fine.
Yeah.
It's time to delve into our sack of email, our bag of post. It's basically an inbox. We've had an email here from Kate, who wrote in to respond to last week's show, who she wanted to comment on the plague of checking emails for work out of hours. That was after a story that we discussed to do with whether or not it was psychologically good to be able to be checking email out of hours. Anyway, Kate writes, as the former long-term girlfriend of an investment banker who still hears the clicking of a BlackBerry keyboard in her nightmares, I felt compelled to respond to your discussion about responding to work emails outside of work hours. Whenever you decide to check or reply to an email, you're making the decision that the email is more important than whatever else you're doing at that moment. If what you're doing is eating Crunchy Nut Cornflakes and watching the Crystal Maze alone, and the act of replying to some emails will make the next day easier, then go for it. You're not hurting anyone. However, if you are with someone else and start to check your emails, you are telling that person that your emails are more important than them. Again, that's fine if you're both eating cereal and watching TV, but if you're having a meal or in the middle of discussing something in a museum, etc., then you are not only being incredibly rude, but you're also proving what a dull human being you are. Sensing a little bit of vitriol here, Ian. If you are as well.
A little.
Kate continues, there is no work email that is more important or interesting than your loved ones or real life. If you're checking work emails on holiday, then you deserve to be alone forever. If you need to work during your holiday, then do your partner a favor. Stay at home and let them go on holiday alone.
Wow.
Something even a little bit more business here.
Who hurt you, Kate? Who hurt? Well, obviously this guy.
They will have a better time without your constant tapping on your phone and might be less inclined to break up with you when they get back. Alternatively, you could restrict your rudeness to a set 15 minutes a day, and after that time are forbidden to check your phone. This is probably a reasonable compromise for most people, i.e. not me. But Kate, you don't understand. My job is so important. Everything will crumble without me. No, it's not. No, it won't. Go away. Yours bitterly, Kate. Blimey.
Good grief.
The grief has never been any gooder. I agree.
I mean, I think that, unfortunately, what Kate has run into there is not necessarily just that boyfriend, but just sort of men, really.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I'm generally inclined to agree. I think sometimes there are emails that are more important than what you're doing at the moment.
I'm a bad checker, that is, I've got to say. A lot of what she was saying there was you know, reminding me of me. Because I do...
The thing is, though, mate, I mean, you're a freelance journalist, and so you have a lot of business coming from a lot of different places. And being on the commissioning end of freelance writers, sometimes you do get a pitch or you do get a commission, and someone will ask you, particularly in this sort of news world, that, you know, could you turn this round in a couple of hours for me?
Yeah, it has happened.
Yeah, I've done it. I've done it to people in your position, and I know you get it done to you as well, I'm sure, regularly. And it is in those situations where sometimes the difference between checking your email before dinner and after dinner might actually cost you a commission. Maybe not enough to completely ruin your ability to make a living, but certainly enough to make it annoying when you realize you've missed, you know, a few hundred quid here and there that you could have had if you were just a bit more, you know, rude and dismissive of your love life. So that's email. Who would have thought that something as niche as work and email could put so many emotions up to the surface of the broth, like a scummy film that a filter really should remove when it comes out of the tap, the mouth.
Oh, Nate.
Not everyone in the world is as beautiful as you, dear listener, and not everyone knows how to download a podcast. That's why I'm encouraging you to bring someone you know into the podcasting world by telling them about this show and which app you use to listen to it. You'll be helping not only me in text message, but all podcasters who often need word of mouth more than money to help promote their work. Thanks for listening, and hopefully, thanks for the review and the help spreading the word. Or if you want to be on the show, send your comments about this episode or any other tech topic, podcast@natelangson.com. Apple is about to sunset.
Did you just say that?
Look, I'm reading from an article here. I think this was on 95 Mac.
But, I mean, come on. You could have removed the word sunset.
I believe in you know.
I believe in the English language.
No, if I say, you know, this is something being written by a website, I like to name check the website, yes. And I like to read the words that they've written.
That's fine.
Otherwise, I feel like I'm just plagiarizing them rather than just ripping them off and giving them credit.
I don't think so. I mean, I just the word sunset. I mean, come on.
All right. Okay. Let's. I'll begin again.
You can do it. I can just translate it for everyone.
No, it's fine. Apple is about to stick a knife in the back of a number of iPhones, Macs, and other products as it plans to switch several models to obsolete or vintage status in June. Now, this is according to internal documents that I first read about on 9to5 Mac. Now, here's the interesting thing. I could go through and list the sort of 10 products or so that are being listed as obsolete. However, one of them is interesting. The others, not so much. The iPhone 3GS will be officially obsolete in June.
What does obsolete mean in the context of this?
It basically means Apple's not going to continue offering support.
So there'll be no more bug fixes or anything like that?
I think it actually probably extends a little bit deeper than that. It probably just means that they're not even going to offer to fix it or replace it at all.
Interesting.
You know, which is weird because, I mean, the 3GS as a basic phone, if you really do just want the pre-installed apps, shove a SIM card in it and, you know, you've had one that still works, it's still fine. If it hasn't been used for 5 years, if it's basically been in a box, you can probably still give that to a grandparent or something. Right. Like, it's a fine product. But the fact is, if they break it, then Apple's saying, ah, it's an obsolete product. It's just bizarre to me to think we're in an era where a product that was, you know, the iPhone 3GS, like I'm sure you as well as I and probably most of the people listening remember when that phone came out.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of us had one. And that's already being classed as an obsolete product. It's only 5 to 7 years, something like that, I think.
But that is a lifetime in mobile tech. It is. I mean, I'm not surprised. I'm amazed they've managed to keep it going this long, really, to be honest.
I mean, 5 years from a product being released and being the latest, greatest, best thing to being, we are officially saying that this is an obsolete product. This product has bent over and succumbed to the unstoppable scythe of obsolescence.
Well, here we go, though. I mean, it's possible there's a reason for this, and that reason might be that they genuinely don't have the components anymore. Like they may have replaced all the batteries and they may no longer have any on hand, and to make more would be too expensive.
It should be a duty to support these for longer than 5 years. 10 years, maybe.
No.
Keep saying that when you're selling this many products, this many iPhone 3GSs, you know, Apple will come out with press releases, and they do this believe me, every time, saying how many millions of products, specific models they've sold for years. Millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of these things. And you're really saying that after 5 years, every single person has not got one anymore.
They're not saying
therefore...
that, though, are they? They're saying that...
They might as well.
Well, no, but they're not. Saying... They're just saying that, look, there aren't enough of these for us to really give much of a hoot about it anymore, and we can't continue to support everything forever. You know, like, I reckon if you went in with a 3GS, they'd give you a nice little discount on a new one, or, you know, on a 5S or whatever.
It just seems too soon for something that has sold so many. Many products.
When did it come out, the 3GS?
2009 it came out, and we're in 2015, so it's been 6 years. When the 3GS has been retired, 6 years.
I can't. I mean, look. I'll be honest with me, right? How much stuff do you think lasts 6 years this day and age? Like, I mean, laptops.
Plenty.
I mean, you know, you're going to want to replace a laptop after 6 years, more than likely. I mean, a lot of people don't, and that's fine.
I've got a Mac here that I bought in 2007. I don't use it, admittedly, but it's there and it still works, and bits of it are fixable by me. But this is a phone that you can't even open the back
of. A third party could fix it for you.
Fine, if that's the industry that Apple is supporting, then that's no problem.
Well, maybe an authorized Apple repairer place would be able to do it.
The other problem is that they still made iPhone 3GSs until late in 2012. That's less than 3 years ago that they were still even building the damn things, let alone retailers that then had stock and were still selling them. And I think now for that to be an obsolete product, it's like it's too soon. And this is not new. Apple does this, and Apple is not by any means the only company that does things like this. But for me, for a flagship product that sells so many, that is such a massive deal for the company when they sell to a new milestone like they do with the new iPhones, I think that 6 years from announcement to official obsolescence is I think it's too small. And I think that all right, there may be some unofficial flexibility Apple gives on customers. Certainly, I've had a Magic Trackpad replaced for free. I walked into the store, I had no receipt. It was 4 years old. The battery had obviously leaked inside, and I hadn't used it for a year, and I took it in on the off chance and was intending on buying a new one. They just gave me a new one straight out of the gate. I could have stolen it. It could have been broken because of something I did. They didn't really question it. They just assumed that I was telling the truth, which, to be fair, I was, and they just gave me a new one.
Well, that's nice.
Fair enough. It is great of them, and they are good at that. I just think that to send the message out that you can go from announcement to official obsolescence in 6 years, I think that's too short. And at the very least, it's worth debating for 8 minutes on a podcast.
Well, also, one other thing I will say is that don't forget that Apple knows everything about every product it's released, and it knows exactly how many 3GSs are being used at any one time. And it probably can say that there's just not enough of them out there for it to be a concern.
Last story we wanted to get to, and this is just one I wanted to touch upon briefly, to be honest, because we're yet to see how it's going to develop. But this is a story that I read about on Ars Technica. I think it was originally reported in the FT, and this was headlined, EU mobile carriers plan to block ads and demand money from Google. The story begins by saying multiple mobile operators in Europe plan to block advertising on their networks, with one of them to target Google's ad network to force the company to give a cut of its ad revenue. That bit's according to the FT. And there's a quote here. An executive at a European carrier confirmed that it and several of its peers are planning to start blocking adverts this year. The executive said that the carrier will initially launch an advertising-free service for customers on an opt-in basis, but it also is considering a more radical idea that it calls, quote, the bomb, which would apply across its entire network of millions of subscribers at once. The idea is to specifically target Google, blocking advertising on its websites in an attempt to force the company, Google, into giving up a cut of its revenue. Now, this to me, number one, is a demonstration of networks basically hindering innovation and getting envious that they haven't come up with what Google has before Google did, and is trying to get a cheap buck.
This is disgusting. Yeah. This is just the worst thing I've heard about tech today.
But if you remember, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was talking about some of the things that I found were missing from the manifestos for the political parties. One of the things, well, the thing that I pointed out and in fact wrote an article about for The Telegraph saying this is missing and shouldn't be missing is net neutrality and legal right to being able to have a full internet and not be tiered in any way by companies with vested financial interests. That would make this illegal if we had protection for that. And it is in America, and that's why they can't do it there. And here, there are no... This is, again, actually a quote, in fact. There's a quote here from the European Commission. It says, there are no clear rules on net neutrality today at the EU level, leaving 96% of Europeans without legal protection for their right to access the full open internet. So that is another problem, and that's why net neutrality is so important. But also, bog off, EU carriers. I don't like ads any more than anybody else does when they're intrusive, but some ads are beneficial and Google has a right to display them in their services if we choose to use their services for free on knowing that they have ads in them. Yeah. Like, I accept that and everyone accepts that. And carriers should not be blocking that just to force the hand of Google to give them money for doing F all. That's the closest I'm coming to swearing on this show.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is just appalling behaviour. What gives these people the right to think like this? Someone else is making money. Oh, we better put a stop to that. It's disgusting business behaviour for one thing.
I mean, you know, I agree because I just ranted.
Yeah, but I mean,
I think we.
I suppose this sort of thing has been suggested before, hasn't it? There have been, you know, some of the ad blockers will block ads but selectively let some through by negotiation. There is a powerful moral argument that says blocking ads is sort of wrong. You're consuming something for free. You shouldn't, you know, it's not taking up much of your eyeball space to look at ads, is it? But then again, the ad industry's sort of done itself over. It's consistently produced annoying adverts that aren't relevant to people and that are just essentially just a click through scam trying to get you to be interested in what they're selling. But then it's some nonsense when you get there. I sort of understand why people use ad blockers, but as someone who's earned his entire living since 2007 based on, you know, display ads, I have to sort of be a bit kind of cautious about it and say, well, look, we can't all block all ads all the time or there'll be no way to pay for anything.
Yeah. This is something we're going to keep our eye on because at the moment this is a big report from the Financial Times, so it's in its early days. This has not come out and been massive deal yet, but we're gonna have to just watch and see what gets officially announced.
The text here says that, you know, just blocking ads for an hour a day might be enough to bring Google to the table. I'm like, no, that's going to be enough to make Google go to a court, isn't it?
And
start legal proceedings. And why wouldn't it? You know, it's like somehow we work out a way of getting some money out of, you know, we insert ourselves between the mobile phone company's customers and them and
just take
a bit of money for something.
I think if it did come to that, I don't think Google's going to have a very easy time because the European Commission is not exactly writing Google down its list of best mates.
But at the same time, you have to give them credit for being able to distinguish between one thing and another. And yes. The EU obviously has some issues with Google, but at the same time, Google does have the right to make money. I mean, this is just going to end so badly because
end in something like, look, you buy by our local tax, we'll protect you from the mobile operators here.
Absolutely. Deal.
Let's just do that.
And that might
They are problem solved. Problem solved.
That could be a good way of doing it, actually. That's a nice idea you've had there because it could be a nice way of getting the government to say, well, okay, we can put a stop to this. But you must pay local tax. Although that, again, it's still holder than ransom and they aren't doing anything technically wrong as we discussed in that last podcast.
I agree. I was about to make a really horrible sort of analogy for this, but I didn't want to liken Google to a murderer.
Just because someone's murdered someone doesn't mean that they've also stolen their cat.
Just because someone's murdered someone, it shouldn't mean they shouldn't be It doesn't matter.
Well,
I'm tired.
Just because someone's murdered someone doesn't mean that, you know, everyone can just murder them. You know, that's not the way the law works, is it?
The law is to protect
people from wrongdoing. Speaking of cats, how is your lone cat, by the way?
Hashtag borrowed cat is doing very well.
I love the fact you borrowed a cat. I really, really want to borrow a cat now.
I took a week off work as well.
Really? Just to borrow a cat?
It was coincidence. I'm looking after the cat for 2 weeks, and I took a week of that off work to kind of relax. I hadn't had a day off work since I started at Bloomberg in January, and I've had so much on back-to-back every single day of every week since the beginning of the year that I thought this is the most appropriate time to take a week off for a staycation, relax a bit, read, go for some nice walks, and hell, yeah, chase a cat around the living room in my underwear.
It's brilliant. There's a cute cat. I've seen the
pictures. Beautiful cat.
Very beautiful.
Check my Instagram if anybody wants to have a look at hashtag borrowed cat Rex from CNET's Luke Westaway.
So much fluff on the chest. That's what got me. It's about 9 or 10 fluffs, isn't it?
It's top quality. It's dense. It's dense.
It's exciting.
That is going to do it for the podcast this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And Ian, a pleasure.
Oh, absolutely same.
Thanks for listening to Text Message, a weekly free podcast produced, edited, and funded by me, Nate Langson. Don't forget, you can help so much by bringing someone you know into the podcasting world by telling them about this show and which app you use to listen to it. From the Corner Studio in my house in Ealing, London, thanks again for listening and for any help in spreading the word.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.